Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker is Dr. Ray St. John, chairman of the Division of English Language and Literature at BJU and pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Gaffney, South Carolina. The title of his message is, It Can Happen to You, The Anatomy of Failure. The text is from Genesis chapter 13.
If I were going to give a title today to what I'd like to talk to you about, and you're going to find that much of this is very familiar to you, my title would be this, It Can Happen to You, The Anatomy of a Failure. Now, in an academic setting, failure, we're quite conscious of. Many of you are teachers, and if you're not right now, you will be. Many of you have families. You may be conscious of failure there. We see failure all around us. What strikes us generally is that if we do what we're told, do what the assignments call for, put our time in, we're not going to fail. And I think there's a way in which that's exactly right. But what is interesting is that what we devote our time to, what we spend our waking moments planning, what our core values are, will produce either success or failure. Three quarters of a century ago in Chicago, a meeting of very important financiers took place. Present at this meeting were the president of the largest independent steel company at that time in the world, the president of the largest gas company, the greatest wheat speculator, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, a member of the president's cabinet, the greatest bear on Wall Street, the head of the world's biggest monopoly at that time, and the president of the Bank of International Settlements. A very prestigious gathering. By all accounts, these men had ascended to the highest reaches of success. They had discovered the secrets of making money. As they left the hotel that day in Chicago, life took them in different directions. It's one thing to see the beginning, it's another thing to see the end. So let's step forward 25 years from this meeting in 1923. The president of the largest independent steel company, a man by the name of Charles Schwab, had died bankrupt, having lived on borrowed money for the last 5 years before his death. The president of the largest gas company, Howard Hobson, had become insane. The greatest wheat speculator, a man by the name of Arthur Cotton, died abroad, now insolvent. The president of the New York Stock Exchange, Richard Whitney, went to Sing Sing Penitentiary. The member of the president's cabinet, Albert Fall, was pardoned from prison so that he could die at home. The greatest bear on Wall Street at that time, Jesse Livermore, died a suicide. The head of the world's greatest monopoly, Ivor Kruger, died a suicide. The president of the Bank of International Settlements, Leon Frazier, died a suicide. Not one of those persons planned on failure, yet all of them, 25 years later, were bankrupt, were in jail, had lost their reputations, or they were dead by suicide. In one of his best-known poems, Robert Frost speaks of way leading on to way. He's talking about a series of decisions, each growing out of that which went before, taking the person further along a path that culminates in success or failure. By now, you probably realize that I want us to study the life of the nephew of the father of the faithful. Please turn to Genesis chapter 13. Lot, Abraham's nephew, mirrors in some very important ways our own age and its values. My question to you today is whether he mirrors decisions that you have made, are making, or will make. Now, the background to Lot is very simple. He's mentioned, first of all, in Genesis chapter 11, as he, along with Terah, Abraham's father, and Abram, leave Ur of the Chaldees journey approximately 1,500 miles, ultimately, although they were to make an intermediate stop at Haran, and there Terah was to die. They were on the way to a land that God had promised to Abraham. In chapter 13 of Genesis, with Abraham's failure in Egypt now behind them, they head north up out of Egypt into the south of Canaan. Now, I don't know whether you've had an opportunity of seeing pictures. About a month ago, I had the opportunity of being in this area. Today, it does not look very rich, fertile, does not look very promising at all. At this time, it was extremely promising. And as we pick up in Genesis 13, we find that God has blessed Abram and has blessed Lot. Verse 1, and Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south of Canaan. And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Let me just interject here for a moment. Your core values are going to be reflected at various times in your life. Obviously, they control all of your action, but they're going to control pivotal points in your life. We think of Jacob, who had a checkered life. But my take on Jacob is that he had the right core values. Inevitably, Jacob wanted what God wanted. Now, he did a lot of wrong things along the way, and he had to undergo significant chastening by the Lord. His name changed from being that which suggests a planter, conniver, crook, and so on, until he becomes Prince with God. It took Jacob most of his life to undergo that journey. I wonder for how many of us it will take a long time to undergo a comparable journey in our lives. Abram, at crucial moments, always turns to God. And it's interesting, in the midst of the wealth that he is enjoying, he goes back to the place where he had met with God before. Please don't interpret that to mean he had not been meeting with God along the way. I'm sure he had. After all, he's the father of the faithful. You don't get to be faithful just by occasionally spending some time with the Lord. Now, there was a concerted and consistent plan of behavior in Abraham's life. In verse 5, we learn, and Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. You know this story very well. Now, what is interesting to me is the very fact that success in their lives is going to breed problems. You ever realize that the more successful you are, the greater your problems will be? You may be financially successful and end up with a second house, maybe a boat. My wife the other day, as we were driving along, said, "Oh, I wish we had a pontoon boat." I resisted laughing. We've talked about this over the past. I said, when would we ever get a chance to use it? And the idea was, well, it'd be nice to have it for those occasions when we could. But what went through my mind was, where do you put it? How do you take care of it? What about the licensing? What about the insurance? And all of these other matters that come with, oh, there's a fancy word, aggrandizement, adding to your life. Now, Abraham and Lot have experienced tremendous blessing, and that produces a problem. Their herdsmen begin to contend with one another. If you've been in this area of the world, you know that water is the most valuable commodity that can exist. And so the herdsmen now are contending with one another over the rights to the water to take care of their stock. Abraham, in an act of great generosity, now, he was superior by age, position, and certainly by wealth at this time. Abraham had the position, but what he does is a very generous act. He gives Lot the right to make the decision. Now, if you can envision in their mind's eye, they're standing somewhere to the west of the Jordan River, looking out before them. And as they do so, Abraham makes this proposal to Lot. You take what's on the right, and I'll go to the left. You go left, and I'll go right. basically, I suppose, since they were looking toward Jordan, you go south, or and I'll go north, or you go north and I'll go south. But as Lot looks, he makes a decision that is based upon his personal comfort and his own financial success. The Jordan River runs very interestingly down through what looks to be dry, barren land from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. And as they were looking at that, the watered plain of the Jordan River must have appeared very lush and verdant to Lot. Just the right place to raise his sheep. Now, as we examine what Lot's decision is going to produce, we learn that from this strife comes a decision that he makes for personal benefit, and what he ends up doing is depicted for us in verse 12. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. Today you can see the Bedouin nomads that are still there. Many of them have a somewhat fixed life. Abraham and Lot were nomads, moving from place to place. But Lot has given up a lifestyle in favor of living where it's easy and comfortable and ultimately financially advantageous. He ends up pitching his tents towards Sodom. Now, we're aware of all the associations with Sodom. Do you think Lot didn't know that? Do you think somehow he had blinders on that kept him from seeing the corruption in the cities? I don't think so. I don't think so. Lot was putting himself in a place where that growth financially, maybe even in prestige, was causing him to overlook the problems in the environment. And so what we learn as the first act of this drama comes to an end is that Lot has situated himself very comfortably. Now, in Genesis 14, we see just a brief element here because in the wars that were taking place, the tribal conflicts, Lot ends up being taken captive. And so Abraham comes to his rescue and produces the armed men, rescue Lot from his danger, and bring him back. And Lot ends up not learning one thing from this encounter. I wonder if you've ever had the experience of a wake-up call. I have a brother who died at age 28 after resisting 3 years in a row a very serious wake-up call from the Lord. I remember seeing the Sunday morning when he went forward and accepted Christ as his Savior. As an early teenager, tears streaming down his face, I think there was something genuine that took place. By the time he had married, had spent a 2-year stint in the army, he was so far away from the Lord that when the Lord sent some wake-up calls, they were very serious. 1 year in February, he nearly went to jail because of financial shenanigans. My father bailed him out. The next year in a fire, he lost everything that he possessed. Still, no repentance. The third year, he was in an automobile accident that took his life. Lot got a wake-up call. My brother, I think, got two wake-up calls, and then the call that took him from this world to the other. I feel confident that he's in heaven, although his life had no fruit, no manifestation of the fact that he genuinely knew, loved, and wanted to serve the Lord. Well, here is Lot experiencing a wake-up call. In chapter 14, we see this wake-up call, as I was saying. Now, let's skip forward to chapter 18. Abraham has just received a visit from, perhaps, Christ himself. We know angels were there, and some suspect that this was an appearance of Christ here as well. Abraham has received the promise, again, that he will have a descendant. And in this case, Sarah is going to have a child, And you'll remember her reaction was one of humor at this suggestion. In the midst of the angelic visitation, Abraham is given a message that affects Lot, and that is that because of their wickedness, these cities that perhaps today are under the southern part of the Dead Sea, that these cities are going to be destroyed. Abraham does something that we feel a little bit uneasy with. He wants to bargain with God. Maybe this is a manifestation of his closeness to God. He was aware of God's nature and realized that in wrath, God remembers mercy. And with this announcement, Abraham now has a proposal. And you remember the figures. He begins with 50. 50 righteous men, God? Will you save Sodom? The Lord says, absolutely. 45, yes. 40, yes. 30, yes. 20, yes. Down to 10. Interestingly, Abraham stops at 10. I don't know how much math you've done. I tend to avoid it as much as I can. But I think math is a little bit instructive in the case of Abraham's bargaining with God. 10 people. Lot, who now lives in Sodom, Lot and his wife, so we're up to 2. The Bible speaks of the sons-in-law of Lot, so that plural means we got at least 2 of them, so now we're up to 4. You don't get a son-in-law unless you have a daughter, so we've got to have 2 daughters here, so now we're up to 6. The Bible speaks of sons of Lot, plural, so now we're up to 8. And added to that are 2 unmarried daughters, 9 and 10. If there had been personal and family righteousness in Lot, Sodom would have been saved. Now, I don't know if that's ever really struck you that one family could have averted that destruction. One family. Sometimes today, and on this birthday of our nation, sometimes we wonder about what the future holds for our country. My thought is that the remnant in a country is what brings God's blessing. And I've often wondered whether it's not the remnant in this country that has kept God's judgment from our nation. A remnant in the city of Sodom would have averted the destruction. Now, there's something very interestingly stated in this connection. In chapter 18, let's look at verse 19. I don't know how many times I'd read through this passage and completely overlooked the importance of this statement. Genesis 18, verse 19, God says, "For I know him, Abraham, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." Lot had many shared experiences with Abraham. God could not say this about Lot. Now, obviously, all of us who are parents are well aware of the fact that children have a will of their own. As I watch grandchildren now, I'm just amazed at how early that will reflects itself. It is it's impossible, I think, really, to accept the innocence of a child, because you see how early a child reflects his own will. Those of you who are still somewhat naive about this, your day of awakening is coming. But it is a horrifying fact to realize that those children who look so innocent are depraved. And they need a work of grace in their heart. In chapter 19, we see some instructive details, I believe. In verse 1, we learn there came 2 angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. Now, you didn't sit in the gate unless you had risen to a place of authority and respect in the community. This is not just an accidental location for Lot. He is, as it were, in this occasion, the official host for the city. There he is sitting in the gates, the place of honor, and there he meets these 2 angels. Seeing them, Lot, the scripture tells us, rose up to meet them. He bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Lot had a lot of spiritual perception. He recognizes immediately who these angelic visitors are. In verse 8, however, we see a frightening reality. As the men of Sodom have desired to take these visitors and work their will upon them, Lot, bargaining with them, even offers his two youngest daughters to them. Now, the willingness to sacrifice one's own family indicates some very powerful values. Lot, certainly recognizing the authority, the heavenly nature of these visitors, is willing to sacrifice his own children. But I would submit to you, he's already done that. He's already carried out a sacrifice by the place where he has located. In verse 9, it's fascinating to see. The men of Sodom say, "Stand back." And they said again, "This one fellow came in to sojourn." That jumped out at me recently. Lot was still an outsider to the people there. He had come to sojourn, which implies a temporary residence, not a permanent residence at all. I don't know what kind of mental gymnastics Lot had made when he made his initial decision to live in Sodom. Whether he thought, well, I'll just do this for a little while till I'm settled, protect my family here. There's a lot of fear in Lot, as we're going to see later. I don't know what has motivated him. But I find it interesting, he's still regarded as an outsider. And the men continue, "And he will needs be a judge. Now will we deal worse with thee than with them." And so here they are even threatening Lot. He is not an insider. They still recognize he's not quite one of them. As we continue, in verses 12 through 14, we find out that Lot has no testimony, no effect upon his family. The men said unto Lot, "Hast thou here any besides son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters and whatsoever thou hast in the city? Bring them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it." And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, "Up, get ye out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. That's a frightening situation, where Lot has absolutely no influence upon those who are part of his family. In verse 16, we learn that Lot is having a great deal of difficulty getting out of the city. And while he lingered, talk about slow feet, talk about hesitancy to do God's will, the men, the angels, laid hold upon his hand and upon the hand of his wife and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him. In wrath, God remembers mercy. Good reminder for us. Good reminder for everyone. And they brought him forth and set him without the city. That attraction that has brought Lot to Sodom and has kept him there is not being easily broken. Only four of his family escape the town. Verse 19, we learn that Lot is full of fear. He says to the men, "Behold, now thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me, and I die." He's just left Sodom. He's afraid of some evil taking him. Would that those initial decisions he had made had brought the same response to a fearfulness that perhaps could have saved his family. In verses 24 and following, we learn about the totality. Now, for a long time, I thought we've got a couple little villages down here that God destroys. The reality is far from that. Archaeologists believe there were at least five villages in this area. If you were to see this area today, you'd realize it had been blasted. There have been those that have found sulfur balls, indications of tremendous heat in this area. The whole region was blasted. It was not only the cities, we learn, verse 24, The Lord rained upon Sodom, upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. Notice verse 25. He overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. An entire area was devastated by God's judgment. Today it's one of the wealthiest areas in Israel. Wealthy because of the minerals that are there. In judgment, God remembereth mercy. Now, what about this for us today? You know this story. I've been just reminding you today. But I'd like to close with a couple questions for you. Is there something going on in your life or in your family's life that's going to bring God's wrath down upon you? What about your own personal holiness? What are you feeding on? What about your family holiness? What are you allowing, encouraging? How are relationships between you and your spouse, between you and your children, you and your parents? What about your job holiness, your relationship with coworkers, with your boss? Are you following after Abraham, a life of faith? Oh, not perfect, but with the right goals, right desires. Or are you following after Lot? A believer in God. 2 Peter chapter 2 tells us three times that Lot was righteous. And we look at his life and we say, Lord, how can this be? His righteous soul was vexed daily, but he stayed there. And that's one of the tragedies out of Lot's life. Oh, he grew wealthy, but he became an abject failure. Everything he sacrificed for, he lost. It can happen to us. It can happen to you. This anatomy of failure is a somber warning to all with spiritual opportunity who willingly place themselves in an environment where their righteous soul can be daily vexed.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Ray St. John, chairman of the Division of English Language and Literature at BJU, and pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Gaffney, South Carolina. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.